Good afternoon. It is my pleasure to introduce this panel, Fine-Tuning the Arms Rights in the Courts. I have worked closely with three of the four attorneys up here and look forward to working with the fourth one. David Jensen, who is the SAP counsel in Kwong v. Bloomberg and Moore v. Madigan, and I can't even say the last case. I liked it so much when we had the other plaintiff because I could pronounce his name. And then Don Kilmer, who has numerous cases. You can check in the his bio. There are so many that I actually had to clear some of them out. And Dave Koppel, who has written so many extremely important amicus briefs in so many of these cases and also is the co-author of Firearms Law and the Second Amendment. And Dan Schmutter, who is legal counsel for the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. So if I could ask David to go first. Oh, wrong David. Sorry. I looked the wrong way. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. The name of the case, by the way, is Pizzutowski versus Philco. Pizzutowski. As Julianne indicated, my name is David Jensen. I'm an attorney. When I first became a lawyer almost 10 years ago now, I moved to New York City and began practicing with big law firms. 2 years ago, when McDonald got decided, I began handling Second Amendment cases. And ultimately, that journey took me out of the big corporate law firms and out on my own. Today, I have Second Amendment-related cases pending in New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and Massachusetts. So, fine-tuning the Second Amendment. Certainly, since McDonald, the spotlight issue has been right to carry. That's appropriate. Say that McDonald and Heller sort of logically leave off with exactly what and how far does the word bear go. But there are also some other issues that are pretty important. And I wanted to focus a little of my, most of my 5 or so minute presentation talking about those. Let's say that the state of Maryland revises their handgun permitting laws and they get rid of this discretionary good reason requirement. And let's say that they put a fee of $1,000 on a carry license. They come up with a cost study. They say, well, look, when somebody submits an application, we have to investigate it. We have to issue the licenses, and we have to follow up and monitor. We need to put a regulatory system in place and make sure people are being trained appropriately. We need to go out and check on the schools, make sure they're following the curriculum. So, cost us $1,000. Can they do that? They're not telling you you can't carry a gun, right? That's the basic issue that's tied up in one of the cases I'm handling. That case is Kwong versus Bloomberg, and it concerns New York City's $340 license fee for a 3-year handgun license. And rather predictably, the city says the fee is okay because they spend that much implementing their licensing laws. But you can see, I hope, that this question is actually pretty important. Would you really have a right to carry if the government could simply enact a pile of regulations and then condition your ability to engage in that activity on your willingness to reimburse the government for its expenditures? In my view, it's the right of the people to keep and bear arms, not the right of the wealthy to keep and bear arms, and I think that ought to resolve the question. But the question is an open one, and it's an important one. And it's one of those questions that, at the end of the day, could result in the exception swallowing the rule. You know, another issue that's come up, let's say that you've got your license to carry, and they didn't charge you $1,000 for it, and you're driving along, you got your gun with you, and the police stop you. Comes out, you have a gun, guy asks you for your license. You open up your wallet, can't find it, you realize, you know, I must have left the thing at home. So the cops take your gun. They say, look, just go get your license and, you know, we'll give it back to you. So you go home, you get your license, you go back to the police, you show up, you show them your license, and they say, you know, actually, we sent your gun out to this private company, and you got to call them to get it back. So you call up this company, and they say, yeah, we've got your gun, just come down here and bring $400, and we'll give it back to you. And you say, well, I mean, $400, that's as much as the gun's worth. Why should I pay you to give me back my own stuff? Well, unfortunately, this isn't a hypothetical situation. This is the reality in the state of Massachusetts for the last 14 years. And the permissibility of this scheme is the issue, a central issue in a case I'm handling called Jarvis versus Village Vault. Can the government give your guns to someone else and then tell that person they can just charge you whatever they want or take the guns? And again, if they can say that, how is it that people have an actual right to keep and bear arms? As my time draws nigh, what I'd like to leave you with is this thought. We can win the battle, we can win right to carry, and we can still lose the war. We can be so hamstrung with regulations and fees that the right to carry, or the right to bear arms for that matter, ceases to be a right at all. And our ability to prevent this is going to depend on what the gun rights movement has always depended on. And that's your support and the support of millions of Americans like you. It is by sheer popular force, power of numbers, that the gun rights movement has become the most successful grassroots movement in America. And I hope you all look forward to keeping it that way. Thank you.
Afternoon. My name is Donald Kilmer. As a litigator for Second Amendment rights, I live in the target-rich environment of California, where we have a lot of municipal ordinances and state laws to challenge. When I first got involved in gun rights litigation, I sat and listened to a lecture, much like you folks are now, and listened to a man named Stephen Halbrook, somebody who should not be a stranger to anybody in this room. And somebody asked Mr. Halbrook, what's going to happen when we finally win a Second Amendment case? And he very wisely pointed out the fact that that's just the beginning of the litigation deluge that will follow. Once the Second Amendment is affirmed, as we understand it, that it's a individual right to keep and bear arms, that means that we're going to have to go back and take a look at a lot of statutes and a lot of ordinances and a lot of regulations that were passed and implemented under the premise that the state need not recognize a fundamental right to keep and bear arms. What we are in the process of doing now with the Second Amendment Foundation funding and CalGuns Foundation funding and Madison Society Foundation funding is we're going in through and trying to take a look at the statutes, regulations, and ordinances of local governments and state governments that are still infringing on the Second Amendment. And as I said, California is a target-rich environment for that. One of the ways in which we can approach the to-do list of the Second Amendment is to try and take a journalist's approach, the who, what, where, when, why, and how the Second Amendment gets to be implemented and gets to be regulated by the government. Fortunately, due to the work of my colleague, Mr. Gurr, we no longer have to answer the question why. We get to say because the Second Amendment says so. So, but we still need to answer the question who, what, where, when, and how. The who, the litigation that's going to be involved dealing with who gets to exercise Second Amendment rights, is not as cut and dry as we think. Of course, Heller addressed the issue of, well, of course, felons shouldn't have guns. And everybody nods their head and says, yeah, that's right. But do we really think that society is safer because Martha Stewart can't have a gun? She was convicted of a felony money laundering, I think, she lied to a government agent questioning him. So there are provisions under federal law for restoring the rights of felons, and there are federal definitions that seem to narrow the definition of how a felon gets disqualified, but those don't seem to be very well received by the ATF when they're putting somebody through a NICS check. We also have a case that I'm dealing with specifically now in California. We have the whole misdemeanor crime of domestic violence issue, and I currently have a case docketed with the Ninth Circuit, Enos versus Holder. It deals with whether or not there is a provision under the federal law, the Lautenberg Amendment, for restoring the rights of misdemeanants who've been convicted of domestic violence. In California, Gun rights are restored if you're convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence after 10 years, as long as you've successfully completed probation, you're not subject to any restraining orders. 10 years goes by, and you can argue whether it should be 5 or 10 or 15, but in California, it is 10 years. For a while, if we're at a window of time of about 5 or 6 years, the federal government recognized that restoration procedure, and people who suffered the misdemeanor conviction and then went 10 years got their firearm rights restored. But then sometime in between 2004 and 2006, we haven't figured out yet when, the federal government changed its interpretation of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, and they no longer recognize California's restoration procedure. Enos hopes to address that issue. We also have an issue on the horizon dealing with when people are put on, for instance, a psychiatric hold. In California, it's called a 5150. If the police come to your house, they see that you, oftentimes it's people who are drunk or who have overdosed or maybe even had diabetic shock, and they haven't committed a crime, but they're clearly having a problem. In California, they're taken for what's called a psychiatric hold under 5150, but under California law, that automatically triggers a loss of your gun rights for up to 5 years unless you ask for a hearing. Of course, then the California statute's not too bad. The burden is still on the government to prove that you would not use or possess firearms in a safe and lawful manner. The problem is the evidentiary burden is very low. A judge gets to make the decision without any input from anybody else. And it's still up in the air whether or not the government has to produce medical evidence or expert testimony at a hearing as to whether or not you have, you suffered some mental condition that should keep you from owning a gun. So it's a lot of the issues we're addressing are not just the substantive right to keep and bear arms, but also what are the procedural rights we use to safeguard those rights? Should there be a jury trial to take away your gun rights if you haven't been convicted of a crime? This might come up, for instance, in a temporary restraining order issue, where there's an allegation of domestic violence that hasn't risen to the level of a crime. A wife or a husband accuses the other one of being abusive. You can get a restraining order. Under federal and state law, that deprives you of your right to keep and bear arms for the duration of the temporary restraining order. And in California, you can renew these restraining orders without having to show new good cause. You can, it could have happened 3 years ago, and then you come back in a court and say, I'm still afraid of this person, and you can get a hearing to deprive somebody of their constitutional rights without necessarily proving new conduct. These are some of the cases and issues that are on our to-do list and that we're working on. I can give you an update on Nordyke. I don't have too much time left. Nordyke is the gun showcase that would not die. It is finally dead in a kind of a zombie way. At the second en banc oral arguments, the Ninth Circuit basically finally decided to accept the county, an argument that the county had been making for several years that, if we can treat gun shows like motion pictures or television productions, and as long as the guns are secured in some way, you can have gun shows. What we ended up with is gun shows are returning to Alameda County. We're negotiating a date for January or February next year. Guns will have to be tethered at gun shows. That was the workaround that the court came up with that we're going to have to abide by. However, stay tuned because there may be a Nordyke 2, because the county has now come back and said, well, yeah, we had to capitulate. You can have gun shows at the fairgrounds as long as your guns are tethered. Fine. We agreed to those conditions. You just can't have ammo at gun shows. So stay tuned for Nordyke 2, and we'll keep you posted on that. Running out of time here. Happy to talk to anybody privately who has any other questions. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll briefly tell you about two cases I've been involved in this year, but then something even more important, which is your role in litigation. Earlier this year, before the Colorado Supreme Court, we unanimously won the case of Students for Concealed Carry on Campus versus Regents of the University of Colorado. I participated in that by writing an amicus brief on behalf of the Independence Institute, the think tank I work at, and on behalf of the county sheriffs of Colorado, representing all 64 elected sheriffs in the state of Colorado, who then the county sheriffs were the organization that wrote our statewide shall issue concealed carry law. And the court unanimously ruled on the side of the sheriffs and of the state legislature, too, really, by enforcing the state legislature's law that a person who is licensed to carry throughout the state of Colorado by state law may not be prohibited from carrying at the University of on the University of Colorado campuses, since they are public government property. As you may hear from probably in more detail from Alan Gura later today, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals will in just a few weeks in October hear oral arguments on the Allen and Second Amendment Foundation's victory in the district court in the case of Woolard versus Gallagher, where the federal district court held that Maryland cannot restrict carry permits only to people who are under an imminent, specific and identifiable threat. I wrote an amicus brief in that case on behalf of, again, the Independence Institute and the two organizations in the United States which are responsible for police firearms training: the International Law Enforcement Educators and Trainers Association and the International Association of Law Enforcement Firearms Instructors, presenting their expert view on why having guns in the right hands pursuant to a system of licensed carry with background checks is an enhancement of public safety and not a threat. In all these cases you're hearing about, the biggest challenge that pro-Second Amendment litigators face is not the lawyers on the other side, because although the lawyers on the other side are often very good lawyers, the way that we typically pick these cases is by going for the best targets that have where there's the best chance of winning, because that is the point of filing a case in court, is not to have be in the on the local TV news for 25 seconds saying I filed a case in court. It's to win. And so you pick the cases where the law is on our side, or at least there's a very strong argument for that, and so are the facts. And that gives us at least a chance of winning, because the fact is judges are, first of all, 99.99% of them are inherently conservative, by which I don't mean left-wing or right-wing. What I mean is they are people who got to be judges because they were very good at coloring within the lines, at doing well within the system. Chief Justice John Roberts is the platonic ideal of this. And they are folks who, when you come in and say, we want you to find this law unconstitutional, they're reluctant to do that, regardless of what the substance of the law is. And they're even more reluctant to do it when it involves guns, because the fact is guns in the wrong hands are dangerous. And they, obviously, they can kill people when they're in the wrong hands. So judges are inherently going to be cautious about finding a gun control law unconstitutional. So it's only by having the right cases with the right plaintiffs, the right law, and the right facts where you even have a respectable chance of winning the case in the courts. The organizations you're hearing from this weekend are very good at picking out those cases. But what often leads to losses and may make it impossible to win a case in the future is when people on their own just go off and file some case pro se, representing themselves or bringing in some attorney who wrote their cousin's will once and is kind of eager to get his name in the newspaper and has no experience at winning gun rights cases. Before you, if the attorney has never won a case involving Second Amendment or arms issues, then that guy's probably not the right guy to bring a test case in the courts on some issue. So much bad precedent has been made by people who went off half-cocked on their own little lawsuit because for them, the issue wasn't really about winning. It was about their emotional self-validation of saying, I'm going to bring a court case. And they go in unable to win because they don't have the legal expertise or the strong arguments to succeed. And when you, and some of these cases just go away quietly and the judge throws it out and writes a one-paragraph opinion. But others, you give it a anti-Second Amendment judge the opportunity to write really bad precedent, which can significantly impede the possibility of good lawyers winning cases in the future. So please, lawsuits are something that if you can go to groups like Second Amendment Foundation, Cal Guns Foundation, National Rifle Association, Knife Rights, Gun Owners America, Buckeye Farms, all of these and others, if they get behind a suit and say this is a good idea, then it's probably a good idea. And if you go to them and they say this is a stupid idea, then they're right. Don't bring the case and don't cause trouble for other people in the future. What you can do, everything you do on the gun rights issue outside of courts helps with the win in the courts because it moves the overall culture of the United States and of the particular state you live in. So when you work in a state legislative race and help elect a good pro-rights state representative, and then that leads to improvements in your state laws or the defeat of things that might make your state laws worse, judges take that into account. Not that they follow the election returns precisely, but they are human beings and Americans too, and they live in the same culture that we do. So, for example, the only reason that we could win in the district, Alan Gura could win in the district court in Woolard versus Gallagher to say that Maryland's discretionary, hardly anybody ever actually gets a permit system of issuing carry permits violates the Second Amendment is because of victories over the past quarter century in the state legislatures so that we have 41 states where the right to carry is respected through shall issue licensing laws. It's only that which made it possible. Now, the original meaning of the Second Amendment, which did protect a right to carry, had never changed from 1791 to 2011. But the fact is, courts are, they're much more willing to declare unconstitutional something that is an outlier rather than something that is in the mainstream. That's why the District of Columbia was the only place in the country that banned self-defense in the home with a licensed gun was the appropriate target for the first litigation. So when you fix the laws, you are fixing the legal culture in which the judges operate. And when you promote constructive gun culture in general by teaching young people how to shoot, by promoting safety and responsibility, you are fostering that culture of responsibility and wholesome gun ownership and use, which is the essential precondition for a positive gun culture to exist in this country, and that is absolutely necessary for there to be the possibility of victory in the courts. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Schmutter. I'm an attorney at the firm of Greenbaum, Rowe, Smith & Davis in New Jersey. I represent organizations such as the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, the National Shooting Sports Foundation. I had the pleasure and the privilege of representing JPFO, the Jews for Preservation of Firearms Ownership, in the Heller and McDonald cases. And I also represent individual gun owners and licensed dealers in Second Amendment and gun-related cases. My practice is mainly focused in New Jersey and New York, and I want to talk to you a little bit today about one of the New York cases that I'm handling. It's called Osterweil versus Bartlett. It's currently on appeal before the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which covers New York, Vermont, and Connecticut. It's an interesting case because the case falls squarely within the boundaries of Heller and McDonald, with one important difference. Now, we know that Heller and McDonald say a lot of things. They mean a great deal, and as we've seen in some of the other cases that are out there, the arguments are that Heller and McDonald mean much more than the narrow holding in the opinion. But the one thing we do know for sure is that Heller and McDonald hold that the right to keep and bear arms means that you have the right to possess a handgun in your home. We know it's at least that and probably a whole lot more. Well, the problem with Osterweil that he has is he's got two homes. He's what's often referred to as a snowbird. Now, that shouldn't matter for the right to keep and bear arms, but in New York, it does. In New York, you are required to get a permit for handgun possession in your home. Now, you know, Osterweil's problem is that he lived in New York full-time for a number of years, Then he moved to Louisiana, where he established another home. But he kept his New York home because he wanted to go there with his wife to spend summers there. And unfortunately, New York says that you can only have one home for the purposes of a handgun permit. And you know, New York law, the way they do permitting is it turns on residence. You have to be a resident of New York to apply for a permit in your home. And New York law treats that as what's called domicile. And I'll just explain that real quick. Domicile is this idea. You know, you can be a resident in a lot of different places. You can have homes in New York, New Jersey, you know, Switzerland, Florida. But domicile is the place, your permanent home, your permanent residence. It's where you intend to always go back to. You know, you can travel, you can spend summers, you can spend winters in other places, but your domicile is where your permanent home is, and that's where you intend to be. And according to New York law, you can only have a handgun permit in your domicile. And if your domicile is not New York, New York says you don't have a right to keep and bear arms. Well, that can't be right. I mean, that can't be right under Heller. There's nothing in Heller or McDonald that allows for that kind of distinction. If you'll remember, the whole analysis in Heller and McDonald was that the right to keep and bear arms, one of the fundamental foundations for the right to keep and bear arms, is the notion of personal self-defense. The reason, one of the critical reasons that you have a right to possess a firearm in your home is to protect yourself and your family. It shouldn't matter that you have two different places that you call your home. If you spend winters in Louisiana and you spend summers in New York, each of those places is a place where you want to defend your home and your family. So it's hard to imagine how a regulatory scheme like New York has can pass muster under Heller and McDonald. Now, what New York says, and this is how they try to get around it, their argument is, well, we need to be able to monitor people to make sure that they don't become disqualified, because when they apply for their permit, we do a background check, we do an investigation, but if their domicile, their permanent home is in Louisiana, they're not here in New York enough for us to know whether we have a right to revoke the permit. We need to be able to monitor their behavior. The problem with that is that that doesn't really work, because that kind of approach is what we call both overbroad, that is, it brings too many people within that rule, within that prohibition, and it's under-inclusive. It doesn't actually get at all the people that it should. Now, if you think about it, if the idea is to make sure that they can monitor people to make sure that that they're not they don't become felons, they don't commit crimes, they don't become drug users, they're prohibiting many, many other people that aren't potentially dangerous and preventing them from having permits just so that they can monitor the small number of people that might become disqualified. Now, it's very hard for a law that addresses fundamental rights to pass constitutional muster. On the other side, it's under-inclusive. There are all sorts of people that the law should address that it doesn't. For example, you don't have, for you to be a New York domiciliary, to have your domicile in New York, you don't actually have to spend all your time there. You might have a home in New York, your wife might live there, your husband, your children might be there, but you might be a salesperson, you might be a truck driver, you may spend most of the year in Switzerland because you work for a Swiss pharmaceutical company, or you're a salesperson, you spend time all over the country. New York is not going to be able to monitor your behavior the way it says it wants to. Yet, because of this ostensible reason, New York says that if you're not domiciled in New York, you don't have a right to keep and bear arms. It is very hard to reconcile that kind of broad brush, sort of scattershot approach to the regulation of the right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment in New York. The case is on for oral arguments on October 26th. We think we're going to have a very good shot at convincing the court that this law simply does not satisfy the requirements of the Second Amendment, and we think our chances are very good. Thank you.
I would like to thank the panelists and thank you so very much for keeping on time.